good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, if you're out there across America listening to us, you can call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast, our telephone number is 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the moment, because we have with us a very, very special guest. His name is John Daniel, and we're going to be talking about his book, Scarlet and the Beast. Now, when we talk about Scarlet and the Beast, most people are going to sort of wonder, what in heaven's name is he really talking about? John, can you explain to our listeners what Scarlet and the Beast represents?
Yes, Scarlet and the Beast is just the title to represent Revelation chapter 17 and 18, Scarlet being Mystery Babylon and the Beast being the One World Empire in the last days. And I trace that movement going back about 1,500 years, and I bring it forward to the present.
And of course, it's impossible to understand what's going on today unless you understand the past, or as Santayana, George Santayana, told us, that people cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it. And this is exactly what it's true all about, because most people don't understand the history of ancient Babylon. They don't understand what modern-day Babylon is, and they certainly don't understand the part that secret societies and the mystery religions have played in the unfolding of history over the last several thousand years. So why don't you just go back to the beginning? At what point do you begin to pick up the trail of this whole movement?
Well, it begins in Babylon, actually, with the building of the Tower of Babel with Nimrod. But I pick it up approximately 496 A.D. With the Merovingian dynasty as it infiltrated the Catholic Church. And from the Merovingian dynasty was founded the Rosicrucians and the Knights Templars. And the Knights Templars supposedly absconded with the wealth of Solomon during the Crusades. And there started a war then between the Rosicrucians, which another name for them is the Priory of Zion, spelled S-I-O-N, not Z-I-O-N. And this battle raged for about 6 centuries, and the Knights Templars were exiled by the King of France into various parts of the world, and the largest group went to Scotland, and they kept it alive, the Knights Templars alive, for about the next 400 years, and they founded what is called Scottish Rite Freemasonry. The Rosicrucians stayed in Northern Europe and started Rosicrucian Freemasonry. And then both of them ended up in England when King James I came from Scotland, took over the throne of England at the behest of Queen Elizabeth I. And at that, then the Knights Templars move into England from the north, and then the Rosicrucians, not wanting a Templar throne in England, came across the channel from Germany, and both of them entered into stonemason lodges, and we end up with the Knights Templars lodge and then the Rosicrucian lodge, and they fought in England for about 100 years when the Knights Templars were exiled to France along with the Stuart dynasty. And so
is this the time of Cromwell you're speaking of?
Yes. Cromwell was involved in it about half a century earlier, during the the Civil War of England, during the 1640s through approximately 1649. And Cromwell was a Rosicrucian Freemason, incidentally. And so this battle raged between French and English Freemasonry after the Stuarts were exiled to France, and still rages to this day.
Well, now, what basis do we have? Certainly we have a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which goes into the Merovingian dynasty. And for those of our listeners who don't know what this was around about 500 or 600 A.D., and it was a dynasty that dominated the southern part of France. But, of course, the claim of the members of this dynasty was that they were of the royal blood. And, of course, this is apostasy, admittedly, and I don't believe this, but many of them believed that, of course, they were the byproduct of a union between Jesus of Nazareth and Mary Magdalene. Of course, this undermines the whole basis of Christianity. But there is this belief that there is this holy blood within this line. Is that a fairly fair statement to make?
Yes, and they actually believe it. All the kings of Europe, including the kings of England, were all intermarried, and they all believed they were of the bloodline of Jesus.
And of course, this then gives Prince Charles of England a claim to the throne of David,
exactly.
As it does some of the carry over to King Juan Carlos and the Habsburgs,
yes,
as well?
Yes, the bloodline runs through all the European royalty, including Carlos, the Habsburgs, the King of England. Of course, they're of German blood, which is part of the Merovingian dynasty.
All right, fine. Well, now, does this whole thing play out? Is there any other documentation besides that one book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that goes into the Priory of Sion, S-I-O-N,
right,
which is the secret society that has existed in Europe, going back to the to the early, shortly after the death of Christ?
There's a lot of documentation, but it is scattered. It is fragmented, and the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail did do an admirable job of putting it together. Now, the sad thing is they believe it. Those authors actually believe that is a true history. That they believe that does not at all question their good research that they did on it.
Well, of course, the interesting thing is that Adolf Hitler apparently believed it, too. Apparently, he had sent certain German Gestapo units down into the southern part of France looking for the Holy Grail, which, of course, we've seen this with Harrison Ford and the Indiana Jones stories,
right,
which, of course, we believe are fictional, and the search for the Lost Ark. But there really were people who were looking for the Holy Grail down there during the German occupation, weren't there?
Yes, and Hitler believed he was reincarnated of a thousand years earlier from that bloodline. Now, whenever you believe this, you try to create a myth around it, and this is exactly what the Nazis did. And they tried to rewrite history, and had they won the war, then the history would be quite a bit different than it was today. And it's very interesting that they got all their esoteric learning from Tibet. One thing that Hitler required was all the SS go to Tibet and be initiated. And they called themselves White Aryans. And the interesting thing is when you go east and come west, the White Aryans are not at all what Hitler thought or said they were. And they were Easterners and not the Western races. They were cousins to them, of course.
Of course, one of the significant things is that certainly he was a disciple, Adolf Hitler was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky, and regularly read her book, The Secret Doctrine. And, of course, Madame Blavatsky was totally wrapped up in the occult, in the Eastern religions, and she had taken her pilgrimages to India. In fact, she even stated that her books were channeled to her by her master, who she had met in Tibet. So all of this whole concept of Nazism and so much of history really centers around the occult, and of course that's what they never teach in universities today, because of course these occult influences are there, and they certainly, the last thing in the world they want is for people to really understand what's unfolding today.
Right. The movement of bringing a Hitler to power actually started about 75 to 50 years before Hitler, and Helena Blavatsky, one of her symbols, family crescents, was the swastika.
Surely. And, of course, that then was adopted by many of the occultists. In fact, it's my understanding is that John Ruskin, who was the man who inspired Cecil Rhodes, has a swastika on his gravestone. Rudyard Kipling,
many of his original
books had a swastika on the front of them. We never talk about that anymore because we want the people somehow to think that the swastika started with Adolf Hitler. But one of the more interesting facts of history, and you can document this in the book, Spiritual Politics by McLaughlin and Davidson, was that Winston Churchill did everything he could to suppress mention at Nuremberg of the occult background of the Third Reich. And that's why most people today think that Hitler just sort of started out in the beer halls of Europe and suddenly was the dictator threatening the whole world without understanding the spiritual forces that were behind him, or the fact that this all was a spiritual or spiritualist movement.
Right. The movement was looking for a man that they could build up and mask their movement under him, and this is what they did with Hitler. It started long before Hitler was ever known, and they were just looking for an individual, and it just so happened to be Hitler.
Now, of course, one of the things that's often pointed out is that Hitler was very anti-Masonic. He actually outlined the Masonic lodges there, and of course would not allow Masonry to be practiced, and yet there are strong suggestions that there was a Masonic, at least an occult movement, which had to do with Masonry, that was behind the movement that brought Hitler to power. What's the background of that?
Well, see, Hitler was fascinated with the Priory of Zion, which is Rosicrucian or English Freemasonry. So all his Masonic heroes were from the British arm of Freemasonry. He was against Continental or French Freemasonry. And during the Second World War, almost annihilated French Freemasonry. One of the first things he did when he took over a nation was round up all 33rd degree Masons, shoot them, send all the other Masons to concentration camps, and then burnt their lodges, took all their paraphernalia, all their books, back to Germany and burnt them. And what Hitler is accused of is burning the history books, when in reality he was burning all Masonic books.
Well, now, of course, the Masonry we have here in the United States is both a Rosicrucian and Templar, isn't it?
Right. The Scottish Rite of Freemasonry is French, as the Scottish Rite moved into, or the Templars moved out of England, were exiled to France. Then, approximately 1750. The term Scottish Rite started coming to fore, and the French Freemasonry is Scottish Rite. We have the Scottish Rite in the United States. We also have the York Rite, which is Templar as well. It was founded in York, England, and was originally the English Freemasonry, the first three degrees. And then after the founding of the United States, York Rite was discontinued in England and is exclusively in North America, nowhere else in the world. It's
What is English Masonry today? Is that the Rosicrucian Masonry?
Yes, English Freemasonry today is Rosicrucian. Now, in the United States, there is in English Freemasonry that is Scottish Rite. It's called the Northern Jurisdiction of Freemasonry. That is Scottish Rite. It was founded by English Freemasonry. It was founded for the purpose of infiltrating the Southern the Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction out of South Carolina. And this was after the this was created in the Northern Jurisdiction after our War of Independence. And today it's known as the Eastern Establishment. Anytime that you hear of the Eastern Establishment, in reality it's the Northern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which is British, but it's only in the United States, not in England.
Well, but then there's a very, very strong tie between this, the so-called Anglo-American establishment or Eastern establishment, and has strong ties into England, as Professor Quigley brought out in his
book,
A Tragedy and Hope. And we find that many of the leaders of this, men like Alan Dulles, John McCloy, and others, would appear to have been Freemasons, and also tied into the Council on Foreign Relations of this whole internationalist movement, and then certainly interlocked with the British. So what's the relationship between the American establishment, which was an outshoot of the English Round Table, and the Round Table itself, and this establishment which has really governed England since the turn of the last century, is the Round Table to have Masonic ties?
Oh, yes. Cecil Rhodes is the founder, well, really isn't the founder of the Round Table, but he, before his death, was a British Mason. Was in South Africa. He mined gold and diamonds and ended up owning the gold and diamond mines in South Africa. And he lived until he was 48. He died at a young age, 48, and he willed all his money to the founding of a secret society to take back the United States. That's the whole purpose. So England would take back the United States secretly through the secret society. And this is what the Round Table was all about.
And, of course, I was headed by Lord Milner, who then began to lead the whole movement after Rhodes' death.
Right.
Well, now, where did Rhodes get the money to purchase the diamond and gold mines of South Africa? Did that come from his fellow Masons? Where did it come from?
Yes, it came from the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds was a Jewish family during the Revolutionary War in France and during the time of Napoleon Bonaparte, spread their family all over Europe and England, and the most brilliant Nathan Rothschild moved into England, and they were all Masons, whether it be English Freemasonry or French Freemasonry. These bankers, this banking clan, then set up central banks in all the nations, and in England, Milner and Rhodes, they were all from or controlled by Freemasonry, and Freemasonry then was funded by these bankers.
All right. Well, now, as the story unfolds, we find this strong occultic influence within the Continental Masonry. Was the occultic influence within the English Masonry, or just within the French and Continental Masonry?
Well, it was occultic in both of them. The interesting thing is, English Freemasonry ended up they both carry the roots all the way back to Nimrod and Babylon, incidentally. But English Freemasonry ended up being pantheistic, and in 1876, French Freemasonry declared their atheism, and that's where the fellowship split between the two. English Freemasonry demands that you believe in a God, and French Freemasonry went atheistic.
Well, was that all of French Freemasonry, or was that just the Lodges of the Grand Orient?
Well, it was in France. It was all the Lodges, which was the Grand Orient, which was the Scottish Rite, which was even the English founded lodge in France, the Grand Lodge in France. They all went atheistic. And then from that developed the atheist movement, which ended up in the founding of the Soviet Union. and that came straight from French Freemasonry.
Well, now, how can we tie the Russian Revolution into Masonry? Because certainly we had the two revelations, one in March and one in October of 1917, right. And we can certainly, there's much to suggest that Lord Milner, who we mentioned earlier, was the disciple of Cecil Rhodes and took over control of the Rhodes Trust and the Rhodes Secret Society upon Rhodes' death in 1902. There's much to suggest that Milner was tied into the March Revolution in Russia in 1917.
Right.
Was Milner himself tied into Masonry?
Yes, Milner was a 33rd degree Mason, and during the Russian Revolution, the first Russian Revolution, which was in the spring of 1717, was led by Kerensky, who was a 32nd degree Mason. He was a Grand Orient Mason. And I want you to understand that English Freemasonry and French Freemasonry are brothers, although they war with each other. In the book of Revelation, chapter 17 and 18, Mystery, Babylon, and the Beast, Scarlet and the Beast, are warring with each other to be dominant. One wants to be dominant over the other, but they're brothers in origin, in occultic origin. They came from the same source, so they will cooperate with each other. Now, in England, we have what is called corporate socialism. Corporate socialism can always do business with state socialism, not within the same country, but with another country. And so we have England, through Milner, working with Kerensky to stay in the war and fight on. And then, of course, Lenin and Trotsky were funded by French Freemasonry and ended up taking over in the Second Revolution in August, November of 1717, and that started the communist movement.
Was Trotsky a Mason? I've read his book, My Life, and he sort of asked the question, where did Masonry come from? I've always wondered.
Yeah.
Was he himself a Mason?
I have no documentation that Trotsky was. I have documentation that Lenin was, and as well as the followers of Lenin in the Soviet Union.
Well, has there been a Masonic movement in Russia, once the revolution was established, or was it suppressed as well?
No, it was suppressed by Stalin. Stalin suppressed it. Stalin, incidentally, was a 33rd degree Mason, but he suppressed it because he knew what got him to power. And if he allowed Freemasonry to stay in power, then he could possibly be ousted by the same group that put him into power. So he then is the Mason that created what we know of today as the Iron Curtain. In other words, the Soviet Union was the first true, full Masonic lodge in a nation or several nations. Everything was done in secret, but Stalin outlawed Freemasonry just to protect his own position. But Freemasonry started in Russia when Napoleon Bonaparte was spreading east and tried to conquer Russia. The Grand Orient Freemasonry ended up in Russia. Kerensky was a member of it. Lenin was a member of it. And when Kerensky was out of power, he and his cohorts fled to France, and they were protected right there in France by Grand Orient Freemasonry.
Well, now, I have heard it said that Gorbachev is a Mason. Do you document that at all?
Yes, I do document that in my book.
What's the documentation? Because I had heard that he had actually been taken to England and brought into the lodge by a very, very powerful British politician. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, I don't know the exact, I can't pinpoint the exact documentation that I have in my book. I'd have to look at the notes. But before he was ever known, before Gorbachev was ever known, in 1984, he came to the West, and he visited London, and he visited France, and he made an agreement with with both of those Masonic powers. I don't know at what time he became a Mason, but he certainly was by the time he went back to Europe. Back to Moscow. And he made an agreement that if they would help decouple the United States from Europe, he would give them Hungary, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, and Poland. And he did that. As soon as he got into power, he turned over those Western states. His job was really to dissolve the Soviet Union. I trace this in one whole chapter when Kim Philby was a Mason. He was high up in British intelligence. He defected. Part of his job was to defect to the Soviet Union and find an individual to topple the government. English Freemasonry started in 1933 with Philby to topple the Soviet Union. And Philby, when he defected, I think it was in about 1962 or 64, he found Gorbachev and in some manner manipulated to where he brought Gorbachev to power. Now, whether Kim Philby initiated Gorbachev or not, or whether Gorbachev became a Mason when he came west, I don't know. But he is a Mason, as well as many of his people that he had working with him.
Okay, fine. And so I see a notation here on page 519, according to Flashpoint, that's Tex Mars magazine, both of the top Masonic organizations in France, the Grand Orient, the Grand Lodge, are now working on this high-priority project, which was, of course, to reopen the Masonic lodges in the Soviet Union. Do we know if the Masonic lodges are open there now?
Yes, they are. After the Soviet Union fell, Freemasonry rushed in, as did the churches. You know, Freemasonry is a religion. All the false religions, as well as the church, moved into Russia, into that void of atheism, to either bring them to Christ or to initiate them into the occult.
And of course, it's this age-old battle between good and evil that started
exactly.
In the Garden of Eden and is still going on today.
Exactly. I have somewhere in my volumes of boxes of books the New Age magazine from the Southern Jurisdiction of Freemasonry. Shortly after Hungary was liberated, Freemasonry went in there and initiated the key leaders of the country into Freemasonry, and in less than a month moved them all the way up into 33rd degree Freemasonry. They had their pictures in the New Age magazine. So although Freemasonry says you have to work for a lifetime to get to the 33rd degree, they'll do whatever they want to. Albert Pike went from 3rd degree to 33rd degree in a matter of 7 years.
But of course, the average person who goes through Masonry that fast has no idea what it's really all about, and probably believes in many respects that it may be a Christian religion as far as they know.
Yes.
Certainly, unless you really study Masonry, you have no idea what, the God of Masonry is not the God of the Bible.
Yes, and that's only in the United States where you rise that far into Freemasonry, incidentally, with the exceptions that I mentioned in Hungary when they went to Western powers. But only in the United States do they initiate them rapidly into Freemasonry, and I can tell you why. When we come back.
All right, we're going to take a break here, and when we get back, we'll be carrying on our conversation with John Daniel and his book, Scarlet and the Beast, incidentally, that is available through Radio Liberty. We carry it. We think it's well worthwhile reading. It's an excellent expose of how this whole spiritual battle has been fought through the ages, through the centuries, and, of course, is coming to its culmination right today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when we have to remind you that we are listener-supported. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you agree with our message, you think it's important, you'd like to join with us and help us to be able to expand our ministry, our message across America, so that people could understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently engaged, why, we'd love to hear from you. Of course, you can join the Radio Liberty family simply by sending a gift of $20 or possibly, hopefully more, to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. Or you can call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, those people who are regular members of the Radio Liberty family ordinarily will get our four best tapes of the month. They'll get our newsletter. And, of course, more than that, they'll be helping us. Because if you have an Internet, you can pull our newsletter down off the Internet. You can listen to our programs on the websites. You can at www.radioliberty.com, and we hope that you will encourage people all across America to start listening. We do this 3 hours a day to try to educate the American people, but it doesn't do any good if we're just talking to ourselves. We know that more and more people are listening. We had calls last week from Arcadia and Ridgecrest and Canada, and we know that we have listeners all across America, but we want you to write and call your friends and tell them to start listening to Radio Liberty, because they're not going to hear the news that we put out and the information really any other place that I can think of. So encourage them to listen, encourage them to support us, because we need to get, of course, onto secular radio. You'd be amazed at how many people who never knew there was a problem have been listening to our afternoon programs for years. It's on a regular station, drive time radio, and people listening day in, day out over a period of a few months suddenly begin to understand what this is all about. You'd be amazed at the response we've gotten. People told me, you know, we used to think you were crazy, and before long we realized that maybe you weren't, and that was even more frightening. And so if you want to join with us, I personally believe that time is running out for freedom. I think that the coming of the new millennium has tremendous spiritual significance for the people on the other side. We know that the National Guard is planning on being mobilized in May of this year, just 4 months from now, in preparation for a national emergency which may come with the coming of the new millennium. We know that they're planning on mobilizing the Army in Canada, in Great Britain, across the world. And, of course, if you get our latest newsletter, you'll begin to understand what Y2K is really all about and begin to put it into proper perspective. Don't wait until it's too late to get involved. We are making inroads. We're going to be on San Francisco, thanks to one of our faithful and very good friends. We're going to be able to negotiate and get on to the radio in San Francisco and then begin targeting other major stations across America. But quite frankly, it's an expensive proposition. I hate to tell you what our radio and television bills are every month. Our radio and telephone bills are every month. But, well, we're going to keep doing this as long as God gives us breath. So if you'd like to reach us, remember again the telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, Mr. John Daniel. The book, Scarlet and the Beast, actually it's a three-volume book, if you can believe this, three separate volumes tying together this whole incredible story. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY out across America. And we're sort of skipping around here, but there's some things that I wanted to get John to verify. I've been working very, very hard at this, and we actually carry other books that he has published. One of them, of course, is a book was written over 120 years ago by Charles Finney. I guess just 120 years ago now, maybe 120 years ago.
1869.
Well, that's, let's see, pretty close to 120 years, isn't it? I can't, maybe it's 130 years ago. Anyway, Charles Finney was the greatest evangelist of his time. He'd been a member of the Masonic Lodge, and he wrote a book on Freemasonry, which John has republished, and then included along with that stories written by ministers, modern-day ministers, who have spoken out in their churches against Freemasonry. And what's happened to those ministers who have had the courage to speak out against the occultic influence within Masonry?
They lost their churches.
And simple, straightforward truth is, you speak out against Freemasonry, you're going to be destroyed.
Exactly. And this began back in 1826. The reason Freemasonry has infiltrated the church today is because of the anti-Masonic movement in our nation in 1826. Charles G. Finney became a part of that movement. But originally there was a man by the name of Captain William Morgan who became a Christian, and he wrote a book for two reasons, to expose Freemasonry. One was to expose the Illuminati infiltration into Freemasonry, and second, to expose the blood-curdling oaths of Freemasonry. And he was murdered by three Masons for that reason. There were 167 Masons involved in the plot against William Morgan. And this book by Finney goes into the history of that movement, goes into the history of the murder of Captain William Morgan. And it ended up, the anti-Masonic movement ended up into an anti-Masonic party. And they ran politicians for state and president of the United States in 1830 and 1831. And then the anti-Masonic party merged with the Whigs, the Whig Party, in 1838, and then the Whigs became what we know of today as the Republican Party in 1852. And so the conservatism of the Republicans today is that movement, anti-Masonic movement, over 100 years ago.
But of course, most people have no idea even what the anti-Masonic Party was about, or who Captain Morgan was, or the fact that people are still targeted and eliminated today for speaking out against Masonry. Ed Decker, who we've had on many times, was apparently poisoned when he was on a speaking tour in Europe trying to get to tell people what was going on. But because of their degree of control over our media and over positions of government, and the fact that every Mason who has gone to a certain stage promises that he will not convict another Mason of a crime, even if it involves a murder or a treason. This is one reason, of course, why Masons can get away with, frankly, murder, and why, of course, you may question why certain crimes are just never, never punished. Have you ever wondered why certain crimes are never punished, or why certain people are never convicted? And, of course, it's because of the Masonic background. You are sworn always to let a fellow brother go. And how can you have a just society when you have people who sworn blood oaths to let somebody off no matter what their crime is? And the fact most people don't even know this reflects the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think.
Right. And this was exposed during the anti-Masonic movement.
Right.
And at that time, there were 50,000 Masons in the United States and 2,000 lodges. And the anti-Masonic movement, coupled with the great evangelistic movement of that time, the Second Great Awakening, which one of the primary individuals was Charles G. Finney, there were 45,000 Masons renounced Freemasonry. 45,000 out of the total of 50,000 in the United States renounced Freemasonry and bent their knee and accepted Christ. This left 5,000 Masons. It closed all but 500 lodges in the United States. Those 500 lodges went underground, and those 5,000 Masons, diehard Masons that remained, were the most evil men in the world, one of which was Albert Pike. And Albert Pike came out of that movement in 1850, was only a third degree Mason. By 1857, was a 32nd degree Mason. In 1859, was the 33rd degree Mason and head of the Southern jurisdiction of Freemasonry. And he was given the order to start the Civil War. And he's the one that brought in the Luciferian doctrine. After the Civil War, he wrote Morals and Dogma in 1871, and Freemasonry had jumped from the 5,000 that were left in 1835 to 500,000 after the Civil War.
And, of course, we've been up to 6 million. Are there still 6 million, or I understand, at least reading the Scottish Rite Journal, that they are rapidly losing members. Is that true?
There's about 6 million in the world. In 1980 was the last hard figures that I saw on the worldwide scale, 6 million in the world, 2 million in England of that 6 million, and 3 million in the United States. So England and the United States has most of the Masons in the world. Now, with 3 million in the United States in 1980, there's only 2 million today. They've lost ground tremendously because of radio broadcasts such as yours and others since the 1980s broadcasting their evil.
Well, of course, they still have done terrible damage because of the influence of the Masonic judges on our Supreme Court, intent upon destroying the very foundations of our Constitution. Let's go to Jim, who's calling in. Hi, Jim. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I did, and it's almost my perennial question on this subject.
Your voice is so much better tonight.
Well, I'm glad. But I wish this gentleman, if he's made a study, perhaps he can in the future. He did a little relating of the black beast in the Book of Revelation to the actual powers of the Masons. And I would say there's a direct correlation. And, of course, everything you say is true. The Masons do go back to the mystery religions of Babylon, to Nimrod, and you can trace them throughout history. But I wonder if you've made a study on their relationship to the black beast in the Book of Revelation.
All right, let's see what, John, have you ever thought of the relationship between Masonry and the black beast?
Absolutely. This is the last chapter of the first volume, chapter 27. I start to build my case with chapter 25, chapter 26. By the time you read chapter 26, you already have figured out yourself, and chapter 27 just solidifies it in your mind. This movement in the Book of Revelation comes straight from Freemasonry. I do believe that the beast of prophecy will be a Freemason. And incidentally, let me tell you what I've just studied in the past 3 months. It is so frightening. It says the beast will be a leader of the most powerful military power or military nation in the world. It says that he will be a consummate liar of prophetic magnitude. It says that he has a disease that brings him a constant calamity. And it says that he will be judicially punished through therapy. He must go through therapy to cure his chronic disease that gives him calamity. Now, if that doesn't sound like our current president, I don't know who it is.
Jim, you need to get the three volumes of Scarlet and the Beast, and you'll have it all right there.
I'll have to get that. And, Doctor, I'm so glad you're on a San Francisco station.
We're not there yet, but we hope to be on it. We've now have raised the funds so we can get on it, thanks to the generosity of our listeners, and one in particular who really believes in what we're doing. So we are ready to sign a contract if we can get a decent time on that station.
Well, I'll pray that you do. And Roy Masters, you've heard of that snake in the grass.
I wish you wouldn't just beat around the bush. Why don't you say what you think about Roy?
Well, Roy's terrible, but I can't even say he means well, but he's pretty smart.
He is one of the most clever people on radio.
Well, and he's made a million out of this whole deal. But what I was thinking, Doctor, if you could steal a little act of his, start emphasizing some of your tapes more. Have specials on your tapes, so you'll get more people interested and more people to help out, and you'll just grow and grow. And Roy Masters, I hate to say it, he's on his last legs, the poor old gentleman. I'm going to pray for the old goat myself.
Well, let's just pray that he comes to know the Lord before he goes to
his great reward,
because he certainly is not pushing Christianity at all.
Well, thank you for having this gentleman on.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Jim. Okay.
Talk to you later.
Well, one of the things you were just talking about, this man, was this the Antichrist you were describing?
Yes. Well, no. Antichrist is different than the beast personified.
All right. Okay.
Antichrist is a Jew, the leader of Israel, that causes the world to worship the beast.
All right. Fine. And so you feel that the beast is going to be a world leader who is a consummate liar, who has some sort of a disease?
Yeah, and it indicates in the Greek, in the Hebrew, as I studied this in the past 3 months, it indicates that his chronic disease is sex addiction.
Hmm.
And that he will be judicially punished. And the judicial punishment, the Greek word, is therapeuo. He must go through therapy to cure his disease. Now, that could be Sex Anonymous.
Okay. Now, what about Bill Clinton? Is Bill Clinton a Mason?
Yes, he is, but I don't know what degree.
Well, I mean, I know he was in the Demolays,
right.
But did he actually go into Masonry itself?
Well, I have no documentation whether he went up above that, but he is a member of the offshoots of Freemasonry, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission. He's a member of all of that, which is tied to English Freemasonry.
How about George Bush? Was he ever tied into Masonry?
Yes. He was a Templar Mason. I don't know what degree, but he was a member of Skull and Bones out of Yale University.
But is that Masonic?
Yes. That was founded by Continental Freemasonry back in approximately 1831.
And now how then about Lyndon Johnson?
Lyndon Johnson never went above the first degree. He was only a first-degree Mason.
Okay, but at least he had sworn those terrible, terrible bloody oaths.
Yes.
Lyndon always had a hard time getting ahead until he got into politics, and I said that he had to borrow money after he was elected to get to Washington, D.C., but when he finally returned from Washington, D.C., 30 or 40 years later, he had a town named after him, one of the wealthiest men in Texas, and certainly one of the finest politicians that money could buy.
I like the way you put that.
Right. Anyway, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and I would just ask our listeners, how do you think Lyndon Johnson made all of his money on a congressman's salary? Do you think that perhaps he had a piggy bank? Do you think that perhaps he invested wisely? And, of course, none of that is true. They had a television station, the FCC kept any other television station from coming in, and corporations from all over the nation advertised on that television station exorbitant sums. Maybe they didn't even have any business in Texas, but they all advertised on Lyndon Johnson's television station. I wonder why. And that's, of course, what makes the world go around. It's called corruption.
Right.
Well, now, some of the fascinating things that we've touched on. You think, then, that there is a very, very strong Masonic influence within at least the hierarchy of communism. What about at the lower levels? Do you think most of the people who are the frontline communists have any idea what this is all about? Or do you think they're just simply misguided idealists who honestly believe in this concept of Marxism or Marxism-Leninism and, working men of the world unite? Throw off your chains, you have a world to lose, you have nothing to lose but your chains, you have a world to gain. Do you think they honestly believe the tripe which was written by Karl Marx?
You got to understand, when we're talking about communism, in the height of the...
I'm not talking about the height, I'm talking about the average run-and-mill communist.
Well, there was only the membership of the Communist Party before the Soviet Union fell was only 5,000. So it was only a small clique that ran the whole group. Most of the Russians, most of the people in the Soviet Union were not Masons. They were controlled by the Communist Party, which never exceeded 5,000 membership.
Now, you're speaking of the Masonic movement within the Communist Party or the Communist Party itself?
No, the Communist Party itself, which came out of the OTO Lodge, if you're familiar with that.
That was the one that Aleister Crowley belonged to, wasn't
it? Right, uh-huh. And that's why it was so ruthless.
Now, what about Marx himself? Was Marx involved with communism? Was Bakunin or Proudhon or any of those other...
They were all Masons.
They were all Masons?
The ones you mentioned were all 32nd degree Masons, including Karl Marx.
What about Engels?
Engels was a 32nd degree Mason, but he was an English Mason, a wealthy man, and he funded Karl Marx. In fact, the Communist Manifesto was Engels' work, and Karl Marx only put his name to it.
Well, we often hear that the manifesto was commissioned by something known as the League of the Just, a secret society that existed at that time. Was that a Masonic movement?
Was it? Yes, it was. It was a European. It was out of Germany, from where Engels was, where his roots were. He had some type of inherited business in England that made him wealthy. But here again, you have the corporate socialism creating national socialism so that they can control the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
If we control a nation and make everyone slaves, then corporate socialism can loan money to national socialism or political socialism and make bukus of money. Political mm-hmm. socialism is nothing more than the mafia. And the mafia just drains everything, every city they go into, and that's exactly what communism did. In fact, the mafia is a byproduct of Italian Freemasonry.
I think it's so interesting that both the Ku Klux Klan and the mafia were offshoots of Masonry, weren't they?
Right, right.
Would you develop that? Where did the Ku Klux Klan in the United States come from?
The KKK came after our Civil War. And it was Albert Pike and a group, I think it was about seven Masons, met in Tennessee, and the Golden Circle ended up being the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, and it was to reestablish or reignite, the whole purpose was to reignite the Civil War, and of course it failed. Now, that particular KKK dissolved. The KKK we have today was founded in 1917 by a Templar Freemason. It had nothing to do with the post-Civil War KKK.
And, of course, it was strongly anti-Catholic, strongly anti-Jew, strongly anti-Negro.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what about, the mafia was actually created by Mazzini, who was a contemporary of Pike's, wasn't it?
Right. Mazzini was the head of the Italian Revolution in 1860. He was a 33rd degree Mason, and all his revolutionaries were Masons. They failed in the revolution, and England helped Mazzini, with the British Navy, helped Mazzini take over Sicily. And from that comes our mafia.
I think that what most people have to understand is that the secret societies have been used to create revolutions through the ages. They were responsible in part for the American Revolution because many of the original people involved in the American Revolution came out of Masonry. And then, of course, they went to France and they were involved in the French Revolution. They were involved in the Italian Revolution. They were involved then in others of the... French revolutions, and these secret societies, of course, then were instrumental in bringing about the revolution in Russia, and, of course, this whole underpinning of revolutions cannot be understood without understanding the influence of one or another secret society. Now,
right.
What about American Freemasonry at the time of the Revolutionary War? One of the things that the Masons point out is, look, George Washington was a Mason, and most of the people who signed the Constitution were Masons. Therefore, we would not have a Constitution if it were not for the Masonic movement. How do you counter that?
And it's totally true. There would not have been a revolution had it not been for Freemasonry.
you have to understand, in any secret organization that is founded, in its initial purpose, and its initial purpose was not evil. There's no way that that any of the kings of Europe could not be thrown off their thrones by revolution without secret meetings. And that's where these secret societies started. And when a revolution started in the United States as far back as the 1760s, the first lodge came into the United States in 1730, and Benjamin Franklin was a member of that. We know that George Washington was a Mason in the during the French and Indian War. That's where he learned his generaling. And Freemasonry in the United States at that time was not Luciferian. It was deistic, but it was not Luciferian. It didn't become Luciferian until Albert Pike brought it in the after the Civil War and pronounced to be Luciferian in 1889.
But what about the influence of the Illuminati coming into America probably in the 1790s?
Yes, the Illuminati was Luciferian. It was founded in Germany. It infiltrated the French lodges. It took over the Grand Orient Lodge and then finally took over all the French lodges and brought about the French Revolution. It came to the United States. I don't know when it came to the United States, but by 1885, there were 15 Illuminati lodges in the United States, and Thomas Jefferson was a member of one of them, and of the Columbian Lodge.
Well, now, of course, he long since died by that, 1885. He probably died in, what, 1824, somewhere there?
Who was that?
Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, yes. But the interesting thing about the Illuminati Lodge, it was exposed in 1803.
Timothy Dwight?
No, I just lost my John Adams. John Adams is is the one that warned George Washington. About 3 months before his death, warned George Washington of the infiltration of the Illuminati into Freemasonry in America. And he warned the nation, he told the nation to dissolve the lodges to protect our nation, else the Illuminati would take over this country. So you got to understand that Freemasonry in its origin was a movement to throw off the yoke of kings and to start democracy. But just like any movement that is secret and that you take an oath on, it gives an open door for Satan to enter, and that's what the Illuminati did.
And, of course, the thing is that although many of our founding fathers were Masons, they were still Christians,
right?
Because, of course, their faith was Christian, and the Masonic Lodge at that time allowed people to express their Christianity, which it no longer allows them to. You can't pray in the name of Jesus in
right,
the Masonic Lodge, is my understanding.
Yeah, and that occurred in 1813. No longer could they pray in Masonic Lodges in the name of Jesus. So this is after our founding fathers.
Right, and of course,